Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. Hi, this is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence Development Incorporated. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. I'm recording this on the road this week while I'm out in Las Vegas speaking at the Agile Development Practices and Better Software Conference. I tell you, I greatly enjoy talking to people from many different companies about what kind of challenges they're facing on their projects and with their teams. And can I tell you, here's a recurring theme that I hear from leaders who are responsible for delivering projects. Should we ship? Or do we delay? Should we keep on trying on this individual task or this issue, or do I need to ask for help? Should we invest in this new product, or do we milk the existing cash cow for another year? You know, whether you're leading teams or projects, we're often faced with what seems like unpleasant trade-offs. It's not a matter of which option is the best. Sometimes it feels like we need to figure out which option is the least evil. You know what I'm talking about? You know, success with a project or team or maybe even an organization can come down to how effectively we lead when we're seemingly stuck between the proverbial rock and hard place. Well, to help us navigate these situations, I turned to Dr. Roger L. Martin. Roger's been named one of the top 50 management thinkers in the world, and he's the author of two thought-provoking books entitled The Opposable Mind and The Design of Business. You want to be a better problem solver or improve your ability to innovate? This episode is for you. Enjoy. I'm joined today by professor, author, and management thinker, Roger L. Martin. Roger's dean of the Rotman School of Management in Toronto and writes extensively on design and management, including BusinessWeek.com's Innovation and Design Channel and Washington Post's On Leadership blog. Recently, Roger was named one of the top 50 management thinkers in the world by the Times of London, and he's the author of some very thought-provoking books, including The Design of Business, Why Design Thinking is the Next Competitive Advantage in 2009, and The Opposable Mind, How Successful Leaders Win Through Integrative Thinking in 2007. Roger, thank you for joining us for the People and Projects Podcast.
Andy, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I was first introduced to your work on integrative thinking through former Harvard Business School professor and also a previous podcast guest, Michael Roberto, in his book, Know What You Don't Know. And so let's see how well he did on helping me understand what integrative thinking is, right?
Great.
This is not going to be in academic terms. This will be in practical terms, but this is the way I understand it. So if I'm faced with having to decide between, I've got two options, and I'm not particularly excited about either, don't assume that I'm stuck in this proverbial rock in the hard place, that the unpleasant trade-offs are not necessarily inevitable, because if I did, they might lead me to think of just selecting the least bad alternative, so to speak. Instead, realize there are ways to think differently and come up with maybe some better approaches that include the best of both options without the unpleasant trade-offs. So how'd I do?
Oh, you did well. That is bang on. I think you should write my next book.
No. That's not at all. But, you know, this is my take, Roger. I think at first blush, it may sound like compromise to some people, and we've been doing that for years, but it's different. Explain how it's different.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is actually how many people first say that. They say, okay, well, just go sort of halfway in between, and I think that's a natural reaction, because I think that's often what people do when they're faced with these trade-offs. They try to say, well, we'll give each person a little bit of what they want if it's two of my subordinates coming forward with different options or the like. The way in which this is different is that rather than just accepting, if you will, the models as they are, and you know, I'll use an example: Izzy Sharp, Four Seasons founder, the man who's built and is still chairman of the Four Seasons hotel empire. Sure. He says, my first hotel was actually a motel, a 125-room roadside motel. And that was really successful model. Then I built a 1,600-room city center hotel in joint venture, actually, with Sheraton. It was a Sheraton Four Seasons, 1,600-room big convention hotel, city center hotel, and I liked the intimacy of the motel, the intimacy and the comfort of that, but it didn't have all the amenities that you'd need to have the business traveler stay. I liked all the amenities I could afford with a 1,600 room hotel, but it was big, cold, and impersonal.
Right.
So the compromise might be to just say, well, do something halfway in between.
Right.
But of course, halfway in between would just be a lot less intimate and would have a lot less scale that would make those amenities, you know, the common areas and the, you know, the swimming pool and the bars and the restaurants, all those things more expensive relative to the room nights you have to if you will, pay for them and subsidize them. And I think if you would have just said, well, we'll kind of try and do a little bit of both, we wouldn't even know who Etsy Sharp is, and we certainly wouldn't know what Four Seasons is, or think it's the best hotel brand name in the world, and the largest luxury hotel chain.
Yeah,
and so, what he did is instead of that, he looked inside the models and asked himself, is there something that I can do differently that would take the best of the two models and kind of add a twist to say we can make that special in some way. And what he did was say, you know what, these big hotels, and especially the luxury large hotels, are saying we're going to get people to stay at our hotels and pay luxury rates through grand decor and kind of opulence and obsequious service. And what he came to understand by looking more deeply at that model and more deeply at customers, he said, you know what? Turns out customers actually don't like that all that much. If you ask them, do you really like being in a luxury hotel? They say no. And which was, you know, which was sort of a stunning revelation. It's sort of, it's luxury, so you should like it.
Right, right.
But what they were business travelers who were spending yet another day away from home and were tired of that regardless of the luxury. And what they missed was the feeling of being at home or being at the office. Being at home is their nest. You know, makes them feel comfortable. Being at the office makes them feel empowered because in your office you have all this infrastructure around you that helps you be productive, both information technology assistance and all that. And so he said, we can redefine service as being an infrastructure, a support structure that makes up for what you left at home or the office. And on the basis of that level of service, we can charge a sufficient price premium that we can have little luxury hotels that have the intimacy and comfort and intimacy and comfort enhanced by this sense of service.
Right.
And have a price premium even at that lower size that would enable us to pay for all the amenities. Because I think last time I suspect, Andy, you stated at Four Seasons that you didn't think it was lacking for amenities.
Oh, my goodness. You know, in fact, to this point, I've only overslept on one speaking engagement in my life. It was a Four Seasons because it was so comfortable.
Yeah, so it was comfortable and quiet, and they didn't disturb you and all that.
Exactly.
All that. So they have... hotels that are considered way too small to actually be in the kind of luxury city center hotel category. They're 225 to 350 rooms, but they are affordable because they charge a huge price premium. They earn a 33% average revenue per room night premium over Ritz-Carlton, for example, which is a stunningly large amount. So it wasn't a compromise, but it took a bunch of the things, the amenities, the intimacy and comfort from the two models, but came up with a way of overcoming the compromise, and that was by redefining what luxury meant, and luxury meant this new, different kind of service.
Yeah.
So that's what these integrative thinkers do. They find things in the models that they can twist to produce a unique result that's different than the two models they were thinking about.
Yeah, and you know, the concept makes so much sense. But, you know, a couple years ago,
I stumbled upon a quote by Daniel Boorstin. Perhaps you're familiar with it, but it seems quite relevant to why it's so difficult for me, and I think for many, to be inclined towards this. You know, it's this greatest obstacle to discovery is not ignorance, it's the illusion of knowledge. And so how does this illusion of knowledge hurt our decision-making?
Oh, wow, that's interesting. I love that quote. I had never seen that quote. Yeah. The illusion of knowledge is this illusion that since those are the only two models, those must be the only two models.
Yeah.
And that's what people told Izzy Sharp. Yeah. He said, listen, Izzy, in the hotel business, there's really two models, and they both work. And they both work really well. There's the roadside inn, the prototypical Holiday Inn, La Quinta, Days Inn, Journey's Inn, blah, blah, blah. And then there's Hilton, Westin, Hyatt, right? Or if you want to go more luxury, Ritz-Carlton.
Right.
You pick Izzy, and so your inclination is easily to say, well, all these people have come before me and figured out what the models are, and these are the models, and that the illusion is that we've kind of figured out what there is to be figured out on the topic at hand, and of course it's an illusion. There's a lot that can be figured out.
And you know, the thing I like about the quote, Roger, is that it's not that we're stupid, right? It's not that not that people making decisions are ignorant. It's that we jump to this conclusion that we know the options and we settle for simple answers to complex problems. I know I've got blood on my hands on that one, Roger, way too much.
No, I think that's right. And interesting enough, it relates a lot to the second book that you mentioned, because in that book, what I argue is that the only way we advance knowledge actually is by leaving things out. So the whole notion of building up a stock of knowledge, I think, is kind of actually not the way it really happens. Things start as a mystery. We don't even know how to think about them. Gravity, why do things fall down? We don't even know how to think about that.
Right.
Over the course of time, we say, oh, there's a universal force that pushes everything down, Sir Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
And then we just think, we don't think that it's animal spirits, it's the gods, we think there's a universal force. So we advance knowledge by leaving out all those other thoughts, and then we finally can hone it down to saying, if I drop an object, it accelerates at 32 feet per second squared. That's all we think about. So if you ask how does this falling down thing work, it's an equation, and I think that helps feed the illusion, which is to say, listen, we've thought about this. It was once a complicated topic, but we figured it out.
Yeah.
It just works this way.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not ever quite so simple. I mean, we thought that with Sir Isaac Newton and the three fundamental laws of physics.
Right.
Until a goofy patent clerk with fuzzy hair and no socks came along and said, that's not exactly precisely right. Right. And what that means is to look at things that others have left out of the picture.
Right.
And the quote is great in some sense, because that the illusion is we're looking at all the things that you should look at. And there aren't any other things. Those things have been defined. I'm looking at them. Everybody else is looking at them. And when you do, you get to those models. And that's where Izzy Sharp was interesting. He looked at this odd thing. Why are people hanging around in the lobbies of luxury hotels not happier? Nobody else asked that question. They just assumed they'd be happy because they're there. And he said, I better ask them. And on the basis of looking at something, paying attention to something as salient to the question at hand that others weren't, he has access to then doing something with that. So it's unclear that you could argue, even though I think Izzy Sharp is really smart. He's a wonder, and he's a lovely man. He's one of Canada's charitable men and the most wonderful guy. But I could argue that's not so much smart, right? It's not like he could crunch the data more smartly than the next guy or gal, but he was looking at data, at information, insights that they weren't even looking at.
Yeah.
So he had this huge sort of leg up on them, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of lessons in that one for sure. And, you know, kind of related to those comments, Roger, I've learned to raise a red flag when I hear certain phrases like the debate is over, or the consensus is, or everyone knows, or the data clearly show. And I know you, I seem to recall you abhor the phrase, the reality is.
Yes. Yes, you're right.
What's the
red flags.
Yeah, what's the risk of using statements like those? And do you have any additional trigger phrases that help raise your flags, so to speak?
Well, probably the biggest one is the reality is, or the truth of the matter is, and what the reason that those trigger me so much is because what the person saying it is assuming is that they can directly see the truth. And in fact, there is very little that is true in the world. Everything is our interpretation. We live in an unbelievably complicated world. And this has always been the case. It's not as though, in 2010 it's really complicated and it was really simple in 1900. No.
Yeah, right.
Complicated then. It was complicated at time t equals zero. So the thing that then the person thinks that they have the perfect model of the world. In fact, they typically say they don't have a model. They somehow see the world, even though everything that we see, as John Sturman says, the great system dynamics guy, everything we see is based on a model. We cannot. It's not a matter of whether we model or not. It's just which model.
Yes.
So when somebody says the truth of the matter is, the reality is, what they must be thinking is that they aren't modeling. They're seeing the truth and they're telling me the truth. What that means generally is that they won't be open to any other model, any other interpretation, because they think and they believe in their hearts that there is no translation of what's out there into their model. It's the truth.
Yeah. The one that really kind of got me upset was when Al Gore said the debate is over about global warming. And I thought if there's anything unscientific, it's that the debate is over. Science is always the most recent understanding of what's going on. And I'm not making a statement on whether global warming is true or not. I'm just saying that it's that mindset that we always have to question our worldviews, right?
Yes. Yes. And I think having a view that our job is not to seek out the ultimate true answer, but it's simply to seek out a better answer. Hmm. And whatever better answer we come up with to whatever problem that's before us, a better answer will emerge. So Sir Isaac Newton wasn't exactly a dummy. He was one of the geniuses of all time, but sure enough, you know, a man who, you know, is famous for saying, you know, if I see farther, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants, comes along standing on the shoulders of giants, Einstein, and says, you know, well, here's a refinement. And if people got used to the fact that anything they come up with will be superseded someday by something that's better, they would all be better off, because they wouldn't sort of be so, you know, locked into their view. I mean, I write these books, right? I write Opposable Mind, Design a Business, and I'm coming up with another book.
Right.
And I hope that somebody will come along and say, that's not a bad way of looking at it, Roger, but here's a better way still. I won't feel disappointed. I will feel, maybe it's exposed rationalization, but I'll feel that I contributed to enabling that person to think better thoughts than my thought. So I agree with you when you say it's over, it's done. I've written the opus magnum and it will always be thus. And I think it's just playing bad for you, bad for the world.
Absolutely. So, you know, man, I'd love to solve all the world's problems, but here's a back to a business-related issue, and it came from a client, and what they do is they manufacture large power generation. So this guy tells me, a salesperson had sold customization to this, but they neglected to communicate this over to the manufacturing people. So now it's a few days before the promised delivery date, and all of a sudden the problem comes up, or it's apparent. And so the senior management is faced with, you know, seemingly they've got two options and unpleasant trade-offs. We ship the product without the promise feature. So we hit the date, but we got to fix the problem in the field. There's, you know, additional expense because of that, inconvenience to the field engineers, but we get to book the revenue. Or do we delay the release, maybe look bad in the eyes of the customers, but we get it done right? And so typical thinking would say you're stuck with those two options. And I know one of your pet phrases you don't like, tough decisions, right? That's what senior management is, tough decisions. So how would an integrative thinker go about of handling this sort of problem?
Well, I think you'd dive into the two models. So what are the assumptions underlying the model of we could deliver it now, book the revenues, but then we'd have all sorts of field costs. So at that abstract level, it looks like it's a complete trade-off. So I know nothing but the problem, but I can imagine. Well, you know what? How is it that those field costs are, in fact, incurred? Mm-hmm. Are they absolutely of necessity that they will be incurred? Are there ways that they would be lower or higher, or is there just this model that says that they will be high? So right. you dive into it and say, you know, well what's behind that model, and is there any other way? Are there any other factors that may make it lower or high?
Right.
Then you dive into the other model and say, you know, that model says that we ship it on time, or we don't ship it on time, so we can't book the revenue and the clients will be mad.
Right.
Well, let's dive under that model and ask questions like, well, you know, to what extent will they be mad? Will they be mad regardless of what we do, as long as we miss this this deadline? You know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it reminds me of the Frank Gehry story on the Bilbao Guggenheim. Right? He got to this unpleasant trade-off in designing the Bilbao Guggenheim, where he did have a strict budget from the Barcelona the Bilbao people, and he could either clad it in titanium, which is what he wanted to do because he knew it would oxidize and have this wonderful burnished glow, especially at sunset, but unaffordable. Or he could clad it in aluminum, which would work okay. It wouldn't have the same effect, but it would be okay and be on budget.
Yeah.
Right, and he came up to the deadline where he had to, you know, finish the specking of the entire building, and he had to choose between these two options. You know, what did he do? He submitted the entire design of the Bilbao Guggenheim, every last thing except the cladding, and said he hadn't decided yet. And at first blush, the contract management people, you know, people who are project managing and were apoplectic, you know, the architect, he hasn't fulfilled his obligation to have the specs in, but how could he do this? This is crazy. When you hire these architects, this is what they do to you. But Frank Gehry was back there thinking to himself, you know what? Actually, for proper project management, actually, there's a whole bunch of things that had to be spec'd.
Yeah.
But actually, what the cladding material is doesn't matter a whit to the project management. They can get building everything. They can buy kind of 90% of the materials for this, be on critical path, and I could tell them a year and a half from now what to clad it with, and it wouldn't slow up anything one iota.
Yeah.
And I've also noticed that the price of titanium is quite volatile. If you go back through history, it goes up and down on the London Mercantile Exchange in very wide variances. And actually, when it's in its down period, the sort of down periods it's been over the past 10 years, it would actually fit into the specs. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to sit there and say I haven't decided up till 18 months from now and wait and hope that titanium hits a low price sometime between now and then. And sure enough, it did. And so literally 15 months after that, he phones up the project team and said, I've decided we're going to do titanium. And I suggest you buy it today. Because he was watching, the Bloomberg terminal.
Yeah.
And it hit the right price. So What I'd say is what's the lesson from that? The lesson is you can look beneath those models and ask the question, does it all have to be done that day? Right. In that case, it was all or nothing. It has to be all or nothing. And he asked himself the question, gee, does it have to be? And he asked about titanium, the dynamics of titanium, and realized it doesn't just have a price. That's the price. That's always the price. It's a very volatile price, and comes up with an answer.
Yeah.
And so what I'd say here is I'd be exploring the model that says, unless we ship it to, on the exact day, customers will be mad. Well, maybe that's not true. Maybe actually if you shipped part of it, if you shipped, whatever, you'd go underneath it and ask, is my model actually valid, or is there something I'm not paying attention to that may give me another way out?
Yeah, I love it. In fact, in both examples, I love that at first blush, it could appear that the integrative thinker is being indecisive, but in fact, they're actually coming up with better solutions that could end up being so much better. And another thing that comes out of this to me is that I've learned, though I've made so many mistakes in this, Roger, that the model of being transparent with the customer is actually bad. It's the whole idea, if you let a customer walk through your kitchen, they never want to eat your restaurant. Or is that true? That if we actually were transparent, that actually we could deliver late and look good in the eyes of the customer.
Yeah, and if you actually had a policy that your customers spend their time walking through your kitchen, you know what might happen to your kitchen? Might get a lot cleaner.
That's right.
Might get a lot more organized, right? Yeah, there are all these feedback loops to it, but all of that requires kind of looking at the model, asking what are the mechanisms that cause me to ladder up? Because you should think of models as sort of higher level abstractions, right?
Yeah.
It's the deliver on time or delay model. Well, what's under the deliver on time is a whole bunch of data and reasoning and logic that builds you up, if you will, from ground zero all the way up to this high level abstraction. I think of it as a ladder, right?
Yeah,
you start at the bottom of the ladder and you build up the rungs to the conclusion that's the top of the ladder.
Yeah.
And at the top of the ladder, it looks like it's a trade-off, an unpleasant trade-off, because you've kind of locked and loaded on all the logic, but underneath there's all sorts of logic. And what I saw these integrative thinkers doing is just going back down the ladders of the models and saying, couldn't I mix and match in other ways? Or, ooh, wouldn't this be interesting? Bob Young, Red Hat, proprietary software model.
Right.
Makes your money selling proprietary software. That's how you make all your money.
Right.
Well, actually, it's not true. You make some of your money selling proprietary software under that model, but a whole bunch of money on service, after sale service. A lot of money at very high margins. Well, if you just look at it as selling proprietary software and not look underneath that model, you never find the Red Hat model, right? Which is, we're going to give away free software and not do the sell proprietary software thing. We'll give away the software free, but we'll have them pay for services.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you got that was by diving in underneath the selling proprietary software model.
Yeah. I love that concept, because the reason why the ladder got so tall is those things worked in the past, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to work in the future. And if I feel like I keep getting slapped when I deliver late, well, I'm going to assume that model is right, but that may not be true now.
It may not be true.
Yeah.
Or it may work, but it might not be the only thing that works. It could be either. It could not be working anymore, or it could work, but there's a better way. Like have Hilton, Hyatt's, Marriott's, or Holiday Inn's, or La Quinta's disappeared from existence.
Yeah.
Nope. Those still work.
That's right.
But they're not, it's now pretty clear, they're not the only model for building a world-scale chain of hotels.
Yeah. At the risk of asking a two-state question to an integrative thinker, would you say you're by nature an integrative thinker, or is this something you really have to force yourself to do?
You know what? I think I probably have always been a little bit this way, and maybe that's why, as I did the research, it became so obvious and clear to me what these people were were doing. I think anybody can learn it, and two, I think the challenge is not whether you can be an integrative thinker or not. I think the challenge is how often do you think integratively? Do you just do it every, you know, kind of once in a while? Because I think everybody, you know, the interesting thing when I write this book, you know, lots of people write me and say, I love your book, you know, and I'm an integrative thinker. I say, oh, good, you know, that's great. But I bet all of them, everybody in the world can come up with an example of when they were an integrative thinker. Like they take the pattern in the book, say, I did this then, and I'd say, yep, you did. But the question is, do you do that 5% of the time, 20% of the time, 50% of the time, 70% of the time? And I think by being more conscious and having that little red flag go up that says, hold it, I'm making a trade-off between two unpleasant choices. Stop. Can I do something better? You'll raise that percentage.
Some I've noticed with myself, as well as the experts I interview on this podcast, is that it can be easy for us, either by nature or just over time, to we can dish out advice, but sometimes have challenges practicing what we preach, so to speak. So, of all the advice you share in your book or your classes, what's the most difficult for you to follow yourself, would you say?
Maybe two things. I'll pick one from each of the last two books. Yeah. One would be when a model that's near and dear to my heart is challenged by somebody, is to not feel defensive about it and see it as an attack of my model instead of what I think I should see it as, which is an attempt by that person to build something better, which I should want. So that would be it. But you know, the ones that are near and dear to my heart are harder to take that stance with. So that would be one. The other is relating to the design of business, where I say the two most dangerous words for innovation in the world are prove it, because you can't prove any innovation, any new thing in advance. Using the kind of the standards of proof we normally use. And the thing that I have to catch myself still, even having read the book, is when I really think somebody's idea is a dummy kind of idea.
Yeah.
In essence, whether I use the words or not, kind of ask them to prove it. Even though I know, I wrote the book.
Exactly.
That's a bad thing. But I have to. I genuinely have to catch myself and say, Roger, you know, the reason you're doing this is because you don't believe it. Stop. Right. Just stop. Chill out for a second here, and kind of ask the question, you know, how could I probe and understand what they're saying so as to give them a chance to talk me into trying it, prototyping it, giving it a go rather than forcing them to do something that is really undoable and that I would hate to have done to my new idea by somebody else.
Yeah, you know, I guess the way I'd answer it, Roger, is related to this similar confirmation bias. That it's just so easy for me to have that bias, you know, and you try to hold it in front of you and realize it and say, in fact, just this week, I'm involved with a search for a firm for one of the top level executives. And I just said to the other members of the search team, I said, all right, before we get on this interview, this phone interview, I want to tell you, I am biased against this person, and this is why, and I'm biased towards these people. I wanted to actually get it out in front of everybody, because if I said it, then it would force me to look for other data as well. But there's I succumb to this confirmation bias, and it harms my decision making because of it.
Yeah. Well, but you're smart, Andy. I mean, the smartest thing to do when you have that is to state it. Like, I think a lot of people would not do what you've done because they'd be fearful that the other people would say, well, isn't that a terrible thing? Andy's biased. But in fact, you can help them and help yourself by stating your essentially your model, right? You have a model, and it's better to state that model because it gives more opportunity to disprove that model and more opportunity, as you say, to hunt for data that would help you stress test your model.
And I suppose the other more to your design thinking book is that I succumb to the analytical thinking instead of the abductive thinking. And I, for example, in the interview, I would want to take the weighted, some weighting scoring model and say, well, we hired this person because he came out to be a 96.4 and this other person a 92.6. And when there was some intangibles that you just can't capture in that purely analytical model, and yet I feel like I'm either wired up that way or just over time have developed that, and so that's why you're writing and
you were trained on that.
I was, yeah.
All of your education actually, sadly, probably trained you that. Unless you went to art school or design school, you get trained to be more analytical than you really are and think of yourself as an analyst first and foremost. I think it's a real tragedy. I mean, people often ask me now, Roger, based on your work on design and innovation, and what's the one thing you do in the education system?
Yeah.
And my answer is increasingly, many education systems have requirements for how long you take English, in at least in North America,
sure.
English, the native language of your country, and math,
yeah.
And you can sort of drop everything else at various times. I would make it the language, math, and art.
Hmm.
So just the rule is, as soon as you can drop math, you can drop art. Not one moment earlier, but I suspect the school you went to in my school, I think I had to take art to grade 9. I think I had to take it for 1 year of high school. I can't remember for sure if it was grade 8 or grade 9,
yeah.
And then I could drop it, but I couldn't drop. I had to take math, at least one math and one English every year of my years of high school.
Yeah.
And guess what I did, and what virtually kind of everybody did, and there's a sex bias in this too. Virtually
sure.
Every guy did.
Right.
Drop art the minute they could.
Right.
Why I say that is because I think that this, you have to keep on taking math, biases people who think that analysis is better than interpretation and appreciation, which is what art is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, isn't it interesting? I got to tell you, Roger, I could actually talk to you all day. It is such a pleasure to talk with you. And for those who are listening, I recommend you get a copy of Roger's books, The Opposable Mind, How Successful Leaders Win Through Integrative Thinking, and The Design of Business, Why Design Thinking is the Next Competitive Advantage. I also recommend you check out Roger's personal website, RogerLMartin.com. You'll find links to articles and videos and other resources to help you learn more about these ideas. And I put links to the books and sites in the show notes for this cast. Now, Roger, I've enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you for joining us on the People and Projects podcast.
Andy, it was a pleasure, and I'd do it anytime.
Well, make sure to check out the links in the show notes for Roger's books and other resources. Hey, last call for you to join our Leadership Fast Track program. Let me say this, if you've been thinking about it, but you just haven't contacted me, now's the time, or you're gonna have to wait until we run it next year. I'd love to have you join our learning sessions, and it really would be a pleasure for me to coach you one-on-one. So check the link in the show notes for details. Well, thank you for joining me for this episode of the People and Projects Podcast. Have yourself a great week.
For an academic academic. Your stuff is accessible. And so you must have had a lot more of industry before you got into the academics, huh?
Yeah, I'm if you want to count my career, I'm about 60% industry. I have 18 years in industry and then 12 years in this world. So
that's
yeah.
a great combination. Yeah.
Well, it does seem to work.
Yeah.
Hey, and I'm working on almost done another book that'll be out in May. So
is that the Diamines?
It is. It's called Fixing the Game.
Fixing the Game. Okay.
And this is my rant against shareholder value maximization, stock based compensation, the 2 in 20 private equity payoff formula. I'm arguing that all of those things are bad for the company. So so setting as your goal the maximization of shareholder value makes it less likely that you'll maximize shareholder value.
Yeah.
Aligning executives with shareholders through stock-based compensation is likely to reduce shareholder value, not increase it. And the 2 in 20 formula for all private equity is nothing but a method for impoverishing investors. So that's the book.
It seems like you've got 3 years of data recently to support some.
Well, I think it's going to be they're rushing it to market because. I think it's sort of timely now. So when it comes out, I'll make sure we send you a copy when it comes out, and we can have a fun chat.